and 1500 AM.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
This is a big week. It's Moore's Law celebrated its 50th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very big moment for me to, you know, look at Moore's Law. We'll talk about what that actually means. It's relating to the density of electronic circuits and how they change with time. And the of course, there was some guy that got pulled off an airplane because he was hacking into the network on the airplane.
Hacking into the airplane's network?
Yeah, through the Wi-Fi network.
Oh, that's nice.
And he would have been able to
control the plane?
No, he'd have been able to, for instance, drop down all the oxygen masks if he wanted to. And you could listen. It is an issue because all the plane controls now are electronic.
Yeah, of course they are.
If somebody hacks the network, they could just say shut off the engines or something. So,
or take over the autopilot.
Yeah. So that so he was playing around and he was sending out Twitter statements. He says, "Well, I can see here. Maybe I should drop the." He was twittering out what he was doing.
What a genius!
And when the plane landed, the FBI came in and took him away.
He's going to be away for a while, let us say.
Well, no, he was actually a security. There's a story behind it, and he was trying to get attention. He wasn't really going to do anything, and he certainly did get the attention of everyone.
Yes.
Well, they've decommissioned some of the voting machines in Virginia. They've been in use for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
They discovered these things just have no security at all. You can hack them really easily. And so finally, after they looked at it, they pulled them all off the shelf. They're not used anymore. They were in 30 counties. And this week we're going to feature the man who started the Japanese version of Amazon. And it's an interesting story. Hiroshi Mikitani. It's not really a name that, you know,
it doesn't roll right off the tongue.
It really doesn't roll off the tongue, but he's an interesting guy. And of course, this week we had a huge, huge mailbag.
Giant. There's a letter in your mailbox.
Yeah. Okay, there we go. We got an email from Mary. Dear Dr. Schertz, I needed to use my Dell computer, which is running Windows XP, to access the internet. Mary, Windows XP is no longer being supported. You no longer get security patches, so I'd be careful. Now, I just got my new Verizon Fios router. It's about 1.5 months old, and it works fine with my iMac. But, you know, it doesn't connect. But now my old computer won't connect to the router. It worked on the last router, but it won't work on this router. What's the problem? No one from tech support will help me at Verizon. Thanks, Mary. Well, I know when you try to call tech support, sometimes it's hard to get through.
Get me started. Comcast is another one.
Well, they all are the same because they don't really want to fund tech support because that takes people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mary, here's the deal. You're going to have to attach your computer to the new router. It's actually a new network name and a new password. So you're going to have to go into the control panel and open up network and sharing icon. And then you can click on the wireless link there, and it will bring up a list of all the wireless networks. You pick the one which is associated with your router. If you're not certain which one it is, you can just unplug the router and see which one disappears and then plug it back in again, and then you'll see it again. So you can figure out which one that is. Hopefully you have the password, and you click on the network you have and then enter in your new password, and bingo, you'll be on. I would definitely recommend that you keep your virus protection updated. because that Windows XP has got a lot of issues, and it's no longer receiving security patches from Microsoft. It's been retired.
Right.
So best of luck, and I would just be careful where you're surfing because you don't want to pick anything up.
Mm-hmm.
We got an email from Chris. Dear Doc and Jim, love the show, and I try not to miss any episodes. I've been using Ooma for my phone service for about 2 years now after hearing Doc talk about it on the show. I recently found out about a new service offered by Ooma for those who pay for the premium service. In addition to personal and community blacklists, Ooma now has an expanded blacklist feature that automatically blocks more than 800,000 robocallers and telemarketers. Premium customers just need to log into their account and enable the expanded blacklist. I just discovered this by accident last week and thought your listeners would like to know. Thanks for the great information and the podcasts, Chris. Well, Chris, I do love that that blacklist feature. I'm also a premium member, and that means you pay $10 a month.
Mm-hmm.
I pay a big $10 a month for my phone, plus I have to now pay taxes. They now charge taxes to the IP phone. So I think I pay in Virginia about $4 in taxes every month. So then I pay a total of around $14 a month for my Ooma connection with my premium membership. And in fact, I do love that. It's basically that expanded blacklist is based on no more Romo. No more robo.
Uh-huh.
Remember that N-O-M-O-R-O-B-O. No more robo. We featured that one time.
Yes, we did.
We featured it one time, and, you know, it's no more robo got great reviews. And so now you get that for free if you're a premium member of Ooma. And, in fact, I do that. I never get any sales calls at home now. In fact, actually, nobody calls me on my home number anyway because everybody who I want to talk to has my cell phone number.
Of course.
And the only people who call on our home phone that we want to get the calls are people who say are, 90 years old and have been using the same phone number to call us for the last 30 years, and they only know one number. And they're never going to call on a newfangled mobile device. So those are the only numbers we get. Now, the one feature I like with Ooma that I use a lot is whenever, because the problem is I basically never check the messages.
Mm-hmm.
But what Ooma does, it takes all my voicemail messages, converts them to an MP3, and sends me an email. So then I can just listen to the email attachment, and I don't have to go in and listen to my messages on the home phone. And if somebody calls the home phone, I get a copy of the message, I can easily act on it. The other thing that I can do, I can actually set up my Ooma for dual ring. So my home phone rings and then my mobile phone will ring at the same time.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And it basically sends the call to my mobile phone through the Wi-Fi connection using Skype. But it actually goes through the Ooma application. I did that for a while, and then I decided to turn it off because actually, I don't want to get the calls at home directly. I only want to get my mobile phone calls. But that is a nice feature. So Ooma really has a lot of good features that I do enjoy. Well, thanks for the email, Chris, and for that update on the expanded blacklist. We got an email from Benoit in New Jersey. Dear Tech Talk, my son's friend is launching an impressive company on Kickstarter. These guys seem driven by a purposeful mission that seems to be a clever idea to bring a more economical computer to developing countries. It's called Endless Computers. They have a Kickstarter goal of $100,000, which they've already reached. Have you ever heard of this, and what do you think? Benoit from New Jersey. Well, Benoit, that is a great idea. I actually hadn't heard about it. I went to the Kickstarter site, and this is what they said. Almost 5 billion people in the world don't have computers. And a computer means access to information, health, livelihood, and jobs. And they said on their website, though, that a few years ago, they went on a trip to India, and they had an epiphany. They saw all of these people without computers, but But everybody seemed to have a TV, and everybody seemed to have an iPhone. So they said, you know, why don't we take the processor, the cheap processor in an iPhone, put it into like a computer format, and you plug it into the TV, and then everybody could get like a cheap computer at home.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of the idea. And so they basically came back, they thought about it. That was 3 years ago. And they finally released their Endless Computer on Kickstarter. It's a cute little design, kind of a triangular design. It's very curvy, modern looking. Sort of looks like an Apple kind of inspired design. And you can get an Endless Computer with a 500-gigabyte hard drive for around $200. And there are many options where you could buy, for $400, you could buy one and they could give one away. And so they're trying basically to get a lot of these $200 machines distributed around the world. So people at their Kickstarter site could say, donate $10,000 to, you know, to fill, to get computers for an entire classroom. So this is actually a very good idea. I think they're going to have to bring the price down a bit because, you know, I think the price point for distribution of cheap computers around $100. But I think if they drive the production here, they'll be able to reduce that price down to $100 just through production volume. Great idea, and I tell you, I love Kickstarter because it's a way for people who have inspired ideas to crowdsource their funding.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on that site just a few days ago, and they'd reached 84,000. I went on this morning; they were at 104,000.
Wow.
So they'd already exceeded their goal. So best of luck. That's Endless Computers. You can still buy one of those little computers if you want. They're still selling them on the site, and you'll get one. You'll get one delivered to you within a couple of months if you just put the $200 in. We got an email from Lynn in Ohio.
Uh-oh.
Dear Doc and Jim, I love to take pictures.
We know this about these people.
And I store them all in my laptop. I'm running out of space in my laptop. Now, it's got a solid-state hard drive. It can't be upgraded. And I've stored all these pictures on the laptop. I got to do something because it's almost out of space, and I can't afford another laptop. What do you recommend? Love the show. We listen to the podcast every week here in Ohio. Lynn in Ohio. Well, Lynn, you could upload your pictures to the cloud. Now, last week I talked about you could use Dropbox, you could use Google Drive or OneDrive. Google Drive and OneDrive are both free. Dropbox gives you a couple of gigabytes free, but then if you want more than that, you're going to have to pay for it. Google and OneDrive give 15 gigabytes free, and which is quite a bit of space. So you could upload all your pictures to the cloud. Now, you've got to put your pictures in two locations if you really consider to have a backup. So you could upload them, I guess, to two cloud locations. But what I would do is I'd get an external hard drive for about $100. You can get a 1 terabyte drive for around $100. Maybe for $120, you can get a 2 terabyte or 3 terabyte drive. And then you could copy all your pictures to that external hard drive. And then you'd always have them there locally. And then you keep one additional copy there on the cloud, so you got two copies. Then you can, once you've got two copies safely stored someplace, you can delete them off the laptop. Now, the good news is that once they're on the cloud, you can simply go to the web address of the cloud, and you can look at all your photos from the cloud. You don't actually have to have them on your laptop. And if at some time you don't have internet access, you could always access with your external hard drive. But that should really solve your problem, and you don't have to buy a new computer just because you've run out of space. It's just another way to manage all those fantastic pictures that you seem to be taking.
You know what? You skipped one. Tuke, just above Lynn.
Oh, I missed. Oh, yeah, we got an email from Tuke in Chantilly. Dear Tech Talk, my iPhone just stopped working. The screen is blank. It won't ring when it's called. I didn't do anything to it. There's no water damage. I mean, it just stopped. What are my options?
That's odd.
Yeah, I love the show, Tuke and Chantilly. Well, actually, this has happened to me twice on Apple devices. One time with an iPad where it just was totally not responsive. And I thought, man, this iPad's broken. And it happened also once on my iPhone. It turns out that occasionally the iOS operating system will hang up.
Mm-hmm.
And when it hangs up, it just sits there does nothing, and you think the machine is broken. That's when you have the hard boot. You press the power button and that thumb button on the front at the same time. You hold it down for around 10 seconds until you see the little Apple thing pop in, showing that it's rebooting. And I'm telling you, both times it brought my iPhone and my iPad back to life.
I do that every so often anyway, just to, you know,
just to kind of
clear things out.
Just to kind of clear it out. So I would suggest that you do a hard boot and let us know next week whether that worked. We got an email from Rich in Glen Allen. Dear Tech Talk, I'd like to jumpstart my career in technology. What do you recommend that I could do quickly to make myself more marketable? Thanks, Rich and Glen Allen. Well, I would do something. I mean, I would have a real project. You know, just sort of redoing your resume and popping it out everywhere doesn't really work. If you're in tech, you got to do stuff in tech. You got to act like your tech guy. So I would recommend, if you want to do something with some of the hottest things right there, I'd learn the Swift programming language. Now, that's the latest programming language that was released by Apple. Now, you could use Swift to create an iPhone application. It's relatively easy to do. There are ways to do it. Now, many businesses are always saying, gee, wouldn't we like to have an application? Well, if you could say, look, I know how to program in Swift, and I've done this application, all of a sudden, you're going to stand out. You're just not going to be just one of these guys sending in another resume. And you could learn Swift fairly easily. The development on Swift actually started in 2010 by Chris Lattner, and it eventually involved a collaboration of many other programmers there at Apple. On June 2nd of 2014 at the Worldwide Developers Conference put on by Apple, WWDC, they actually released the first app that had been written in Swift. And the beta version of the language was released to registered Apple developers at that time. That was in June of 2014. Now, Swift programming language. Now, also, Apple has a Swift programming language manual, 500-page manual, that is free. You just download it from the iBook store. So I'd go there. Mm-hmm. Now, there are also many online classes to learn Swift. Now, Stratford students have access to a great resource, lynda.com. We featured, of course, Lynda, who started lynda.com last week. They have an excellent course on Swift, an online course on Swift. And they also have a course on developing an application. So you could actually go in and you could subscribe to lynda.com for not much money. I mean, I don't know. I'm not quite certain what it is, but it's very reasonable, the monthly subscription, to have access to all their materials. Then you could go in and take that online course on Swift. There's another course on making an application, and then you could write your own application. I'll tell you, our Stratford students love having lynda.com as a resource. And just remember, tech resumes without projects are a dime a dozen. So put in some projects and put yourself in demand.
There you go.
Listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll get back to you during the show, and I may even email you directly.
If you're lucky.
Yes, if you're lucky.
But you will get an answer.
That's right.
If it's Saturday morning, kids, you must be listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. More of our show coming up in just a moment. Stay with us.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Hiroshi Mikitani. Hiroshi Mikitani is the co-founder.
Nice job on the name, by the way.
Well, thank you. Hiroshi Mikitani. You know what his nickname is? Mickey.
I was trying to go with something stupid, but
Hiroshi Mikitani. So they, you know, his friends call him Mickey, but I'm going to call him Hiroshi because
That's what his mom called him.
Hiroshi, come in for dinner. he was co-founder and CEO of Rakuten, which is known as the Japanese version of Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Mikitani was born March 11th, 1965 in Kobe, Japan. In 1988, he graduated from the Hitotsubashi University in Tokyo with a Bachelor of Science in Commerce. Now, he loved to play tennis. I mean, he was an accomplished tennis player. And when he graduated from college, he was thinking of going pro. And he talked to his mom, and she said, Hiroshi, I think that's a bad idea. I don't think you should go pro. So instead of going pro, he joined the Industrial Bank of Japan to make his mom happy in 1988. Now, they called that the IBJ, Industrial Bank of Japan. The IBJ transferred him to the U.S. and sent him to Harvard Graduate School in the evening. And he ended up earning an MBA from Harvard in 1993. Now, one of the first things he noticed when he went to Harvard and worked on his MBA is that Americans respected entrepreneurs a lot more than Japanese did. See, Japanese, you know, the sort of the culture was work for a big company, stay with your whole life. The idea of starting a company just wasn't respected that much in Japan. But in the U.S., it was respected. And so it sort of changed his perspective on the whole thing. And he said, you know, starting my own business may not be such a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
In January 17th, 1995, the Kobe earthquake hit Japan. He was born in Kobe, so Kobe, where he grew up, was, you know, ground central for that earthquake. It killed thousands of people, including his aunt and uncle and some friends. And that really awakened him, and he realized about the fragility of life, and, you know, maybe he ought to really do what he loves instead of just keeping a job. And so a year after that, he left the bank. And he decided to start his own consulting company called the Crimson Group. Now, it was named after the Harvard colors, which were crimson.
Mm-hmm.
So he called it the Crimson Group, since he had now had an MBA from Harvard. Now, in 1997, working with three partners, he developed a platform to help mom-and-pop retail stores sell their products online. So you remember back in 97, this was just when the internet was coming out. People didn't quite know how to do it. And he looked around Kobe and all these shop owners, their shops had been destroyed, and he wanted to help revitalize the Japanese economy. He wanted to help people. He wanted to help these mom-and-pop shops, you know, broaden their horizon to sell more products. So he thought, okay, I'm going to do this. So he didn't rely on outside investors. He invested $250,000 of his own money to kind of start this business, Rakuten. Which is a Japanese word that means optimism. And so he started Rakuten with the $250,000. He drafted his wife to run the back office. I don't think she had much choice. She ran the back office. She ran back office from home, from the kitchen. And so he started doing this. Now, his idea was to make selling easy for the merchant. It was all about the merchant. He wanted to help the merchants there in Kobe, you know, recover from the earthquake. He wanted to set up a system where merchants could communicate with their customers, where they could build brand loyalty with themselves. Now, this is in contrast to Amazon, which is all about the customer. And Amazon doesn't care which merchant you buy from. So Amazon sort of gives short shrift to the merchants And the merchants are always feeling that Amazon's trying to cut them out, giving them not enough percentage of the profit. Amazon is trying to maintain them as Amazon customers and not letting the merchant maintain them as customers. So it's all customer-centric at Amazon, and this is merchant-centric at Rakuten. That's the fundamental difference. Now, he was president of Rakuten when it was started in 1997, and in 2001 he became chairman. He decided just to move up and become chairman of his own organization. Now, they started with 13 shops. Most of these were Mikitani's friends whose shops had been damaged in the earthquake, and they started that. Now, he didn't think that going out to the shopkeepers, they should have some slick-dressed, highly-suited guys going out here selling this stuff like IBM salesmen. He didn't think they could connect to the shop owners. Mm-hmm. So what his nail salesmen in the beginning would do, they would frequently go outside of a shop. They would do push-ups and exercise. They'd be running, and they'd build up a sweat. And then they would go into the shop owner, totally exhausted. And they wouldn't look like slick salesmen. They just look like regular guys. Mm-hmm. Regular guys who were trying to survive. They thought that was a better image for Rakuten in the beginning. And so that was kind of the strategy. So by the second year, he was up to 320 merchants who had signed up with, they called it Rakuten Ishiba means market. By the end of 1999, they had 1,800 merchants. So Rakuten tries to create a personalized, bazaar-like shopping experience. Instead of emphasizing like efficiency, like you want to go in and buy light bulbs, and they find a quick, like at Amazon, a quick way to search for light bulbs and buy them. He wanted to make it sort of like a bazaar. You kind of look around, you kind of enjoy looking around the Rakuten site. Looking around the Rakuten site, he wanted to be as much fun as walking around a bazaar.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to buy anything. You can just enjoy the sights and the sounds. So he wanted to get that kind of feeling. And then if occasionally you run across something you love, you buy it. So it's like a different philosophy.
Like a lot of browsing going on.
A lot of browsing. And so Rakuten was getting 80% of its revenue from sales commissions and merchant membership fees because the merchants would have to pay a membership fee to get a storefront on Rakuten, and then Rakuten would get a little percentage of anything they would sell. And they also had advertising. And so, like, store shops could, say, have banner ads to drive people to their storefront. So he got 10% of that from advertising, and he got 10% from auctions. Since it was started, it's become the number one e-commerce site in Japan. Now, he decided to expand beyond Japan. So he did that through acquisition. Then he purchased buy.com in the U.S. And I realized I get a lot of emails from Rakuten at buy.com. I get a lot of these. I'm on their list, apparently. Mm-hmm. I didn't even realize it. So I get that. He also bought Akita in Brazil. He bought play.com in the U.K. He bought Kobo in Canada. And recently, he just invested $100 million in Pinterest. Because what he wants to do, he wants people to take the pictures in his bazaar-like site and pin them on Pinterest.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And so he wants to, because Pinterest really could support a shopping experience. If you find something that you like that somebody's pinned on their bulletin board, then you just click on that, and then it would go to the Rakuten site, and you could buy it there. So he was using Pinterest as a way to expand the site. He believes that his approach will actually allow him to compete ultimately with Amazon. Now, the jury's out on that, but he's certainly moving ahead quickly with this expansion plan. In 2010, he declared English as the official language of Rakuten. Only English could be spoken at the office. Now, for a Japanese company, this was very un-Japanese-like. And a lot of the CEOs of other companies, like the CEO of Sony, said, well, that is just stupid. I mean, that was the word that they used. But what I'll just call him Mickey. That's what his friends call him.
Why not?
Is that okay?
That's fine by me.
So what Mickey said, he said, look, he said, I don't care what these guys said. He said, if you want to compete globally in the world and go beyond the boundaries of Japan, you've got to be English. You've got to use English because that is the language of the internet. If he wants to compete with Amazon, they've got to know English. So now after he started that in 2010, and now 85% of his employees now speak English. They have to speak English at work, and they had to learn English. And so this was actually a kind of a bold move. And so people view him as very un-Japanese-like. But he learned English at age 7 because his dad was a professor, and he taught a few years at Yale. And while his dad was teaching at Yale, he learned English. Mickey learned English. So, and this was actually this initiative to have English as the official language of Rakuten was actually written up as a Harvard case study as something which was very interesting strategy. In 2013, Rakuten earned $400 million on a revenue of $5.3 billion. So this is where they are a little bit different than Amazon. Amazon doesn't make a profit. They've got a lot of revenue but no profit. Well, mm-hmm. he made $400 million on $5.3 billion in revenue. In September 2014, Rakuten had 11,000 employees. In April of 2015, that's this month, I just looked it up this morning, actually. It had a market cap of $24.2 billion.
Crazy.
So Mickey is married, has two children. He's currently valued at $8.7 billion. So he's got roughly a 30% stake in Rakuten, which makes him $8.7 billion. And on the Forbes magazine list of billionaires, he's number 151 in the world. So Mickey's done quite well for himself.
He certainly has.
And I think that was a good strategy to go ahead and start his own business. So there you go. Everything you want to know about Hiroshi Mikitani, the co-founder and CEO of Rakuten.
Very good. You are listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.9 FM HD2. Hope you were paying strict attention to profiles in IT because your chance to take that knowledge and turn it into free food is coming up next with a pop quiz. Stand by. Be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to Classroom of the Airwaves. You thought this was a radio show, but no, it's a classroom. And that means you have to pay attention to what we say on this show. Now, we're going to assess your knowledge by giving you a pop quiz. If you get the right answer to the pop quiz, you'll get two tickets to fine dining at the Escoffier Dining Room or the Karim Dining Room. Earlier in the show, we talked about Hiroshi Mikitani, the CEO and co-founder of Rakuten, the Japanese Amazon. Now, when Mickey, as his friends call him, decided that he was going to quit the bank, he started a consulting company. What was the name of that consulting company?
There you go. If you have the answer to that question, you need to get it to us fast. If you're calling from west of Kobe, Japan, it's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from east of the Falls Church campus at Stratford University, it's 877-936-9333. Anyone else, everywhere else, may call us on the wild card line, 877-936-9333. But I'm sure I've left something out.
Yes, if you're calling from Galapagos Islands, you can reach us directly on Skype. Simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1, and your call will be forwarded to the studio free of charge.
Where did Galapagos Island come from?
I don't know. That's my dream, to go to the Galapagos Islands.
You can attain that.
That's my dream, and I want to go there and scuba dive.
I'm sure that's within your reach.
I want to go scuba diving and look at those giant tortoises. Okay, Virginia has decommissioned a bunch of voting machines after learning of the security gaps. Now, these machines have been used for 10 years. I mean, they've been used for a couple of presidential elections, a lot of elections, and had all kinds of holes in them. They were called WinVote devices, W-I-N-V-O-T devices, and the Virginia IT agency called VITA, V-I-T-A, Virginia IT Agency, wrote a report, and VITA said that these machines are just not secure. They're used in 30 counties in the state. VITA investigation was kicked off after one of the machines displayed an error message and it was unable to report the tally of votes from an election held last year. Now, many of the systems allowed for the administrator to access either with the default password admin, you didn't even have to change it, or you could have an easily guessed password like A, B, C, D, E. And there were some pretty simple passwords in here, and the machine let you put any kind of simple password in. That's not really good if you want to have a secure system, because people could log in and change the vote tally.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you had a strong password on the box, there was another problem. There was an always-on Wi-Fi connection that used WEP encryption. And WEP encryption, if you sit there and sniff it for 5 or 10 minutes, you can actually get the encryption key, because the key doesn't change between packets, and you can actually break into a WEP Wi-Fi network fairly easily. So, you see, somebody could actually sit out in the parking. Think about this. They could sit in the parking lot with a Wi-Fi detector. They could sniff the WEP key. They could log on to the machines from their car, and they could change the vote tally.
That's crazy.
I mean, that's not really that secure, is it?
No, it's not secure at all.
Nobody would even know it. In addition to that, the WinVote systems were based on the Microsoft operating system using Windows XP 2002, which is no longer supported. And researchers found a boatload of security flaws in it that are well known all the way back to 2004. In addition, these machines had accessible USB ports. So you could take and pop in something into the USB port, and you could put malware in that device, in the machine, and the malware, because you got all these security flaws in Windows XP 2002, you could use the malware to go in there and alter the vote totals. Now, they said the USB port was actually locked up, but they said the lock behind it was so Mickey Mouse that it could easily be bypassed. They didn't use the word Mickey Mouse. They said it could easily be bypassed.
Easily, but...
And it was vulnerable.
We like to do things in plain English.
And it was
here.
Vulnerable, So shortly after the VITA report was published, the Board of Elections was in horror, and they immediately decertified the machines.
Wow.
So these WinVote boxes were built by Texas-based Advanced Voting Solutions, and that company went out of business in 2007.
Interesting.
So there you go. I think Virginia made the right decision decommissioning those voting machines.
Doc, we don't have a winner yet, so why don't you ask the question again, please?
Okay, we were featuring Hiroshi Mikitani, the co-founder of Rakuten, known as Japanese Amazon. What was the name of his consulting company that he started, and it had something to do with the Harvard colors?
There you go. And let's ask an alternate question, just so he maybe...
An alternate question is, what did the word Rakuten, what is that? Where did he come up with that, and what does that mean?
In English.
In English. So right. You could, it would...
French.
In Japanese, it's Rakuten. No, but and so what is it in English?
Exactly.
Yeah, what is translated in English? Okay, so while we're waiting, let's just talk about this computer security expert that got pulled off the flight.
This is crazy.
Chris Roberts. He was a Colorado-based security fiend, as he likes to say, but he's a computer expert. And he's been actually, for the past several years, he and his company have been analyzing security systems on board Boeing aircraft and Airbus aircraft. And these systems have become more and more network-centric. Everything is controlled on the network. And they have been notifying these vendors, Boeing and Airbus, that there are problems. So what he did, he decided while he was on board the plane, because they were ignoring him. So he decided, he went on board plane, he opened up his laptop. Have you ever seen the little boxes underneath the seats?
Yes.
These boxes underneath the seats actually have, that you can actually connect to the plane's network system in those boxes. So he went down to the box under his seat, and he plugged his laptop into the box underneath the seat. And then he started checking things around. So he found himself, and he saw one box that said box, IFE, ICE, SATCOM. He had gotten really to the satellite communications device, and he said, well, should I start playing with the EICAS messages? These are the SATCOM messages. Should I start sending out bogus messages from this aircraft? Oh, how about this? How about if I just drop the oxygen mask?
Great.
Does anybody, what do you think? And he started tweeting these things out.
Mm-hmm.
And it just totally terrified.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, they didn't know who was there because, you get into the network, maybe you could turn off the engines or something. So he was basically concerned how easy it was to connect a laptop to the box beneath an airline seat and connect to all the airplane systems in action. So he did these tweets. And after the plane landed, he was pulled off the plane by the FBI. He was handcuffed. They confiscated his computer so they could do computer forensics, and they put him in detainment.
He should not have been surprised by this.
So he continued to tweet about it, and he said, United even sent him an email asking him how he enjoyed his flight. So they finally did realize that this guy was just a security expert trying to help things out, and they released him. He's still talking about it. But he is very frustrated because he says the IFE, the flight control system in commercial airplanes, are supposed to be isolated from the entertainment systems are supposed to be isolated from the flight and navigation systems.
You would think so.
But it turns out that, these are all software, firewalls, and the separation is not as complete as it should be, and you can hack into it. So he told CNN that he's tried connecting to flight systems 15 to 20 times, and he's seen all sorts of things like flight management systems. He's tried to tell Boeing and Airbus this, but they just won't listen to him. But now after this tweet, he finally got somebody's attention. So here's the deal. If you go into an airplane and you see some guy with a laptop and he's like plugging into the box underneath the seat, I'd call the stewardess.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
So there you go.
Or the air marshal.
That's right.
All right. We actually have a contestant on the phone, Dr.
Okay,
Schertz. We're going
very
to go to
good.
Line number one. This is Jim calling from Vienna, Virginia. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. How are you?
Good, thanks. Dr. Schertz, this will be question number one.
Question number one. Hiroshi Mikitani. What was the name of the consulting company that he started right after he quit the bank?
It was named Crimson.
That is correct. That is correct. Very good.
Jim, you are our winner today. Thank you for listening, and thanks for calling. I'm going to put you on hold. Andrew Mitchell will be right with you to get your information. This is the Pop Quiz, which we play every week here on Tech Talk Radio. Hope you will join us another weekend and play that game with us as well. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, and 107.7 FM HD2. We will be back with more in just a moment.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Moore's Law turns 50. This is an exciting week for me because I just really love Moore's Law. 50 years ago, on Sunday, that would be tomorrow, the Electronics Magazine published a very technical paper by Gordon Moore. Gordon Moore at the time was research director of William Shockley's Fairchild Semiconductor Lab, and he later was a co-founder of Intel that makes all of the chips. In that article, Moore observed that the number of electronic components that were fitting on a chip, at least in his laboratory, was about 60. And he noted that the number of components on a chip was roughly doubling every year since the first silicon transistor had been invented in 1959. So Moore blindly extrapolated the trend to 10 years in the future. And he extrapolated it on a semi-log plot where the time was a linear one, but the number of transistors was logarithmic. And then he projected that by 1975, there would be 65,000 chips or transistors on a chip. And that was remarkably accurate. So Moore's Law became kind of the standard by which people would project chip density. So in 1990, so following Moore's Law, in 1971, they had around 2,300 transistors on a chip. By the year, and we're up now on the Intel Core 5 chips. We're up to 1.3 billion transistors on a chip, and they're still following Moore's Law. Now, Moore, who's now 86, you know, didn't really derive the law. He just simply observed it and projected it, and it would just turned out to be remarkably accurate. Now, the observation that Moore made in that article was dubbed Moore's Law by Carver Mead, who was a professor at Caltech. Mead went further. He and Lynn Conway at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center codified the principles by designing very large-scale integrated circuits, which actually propelled the whole chip industry. Now, Moore's observation as a law had a drawback because it suggested that Moore had actually derived it from some sort of basic principles, but he didn't. He just observed it, and it became codified as Moore's Law. Now, it actually then was modified later on to say that complexity would double every 18 months, which was then proposed by Dave House of Intel. Now, that was actually quite interesting. Now, the question is, how long will we be able to sustain Moore's Law? You see, because in order to get higher and higher density on the chip, the devices have to get smaller and smaller and smaller. Right. So it turns out you start running into limits. The more density you have, then you've got heat problems because you've got to get the heat away from all those transistors. But you run into another problem. You actually start having quantum effects. When the transistors get smaller and smaller and smaller, it turns out the transistor behavior changes. When the gates get smaller and smaller, it changes. If you make the oxides thinner and thinner, things change. You start getting tunneling effects, quantum effects. And so you eventually reach a point where you can't go any further because of quantum effects. But as you approach the quantum limit, you have other problems. It becomes more and more expensive to get higher and higher density chips because any kind of flaw makes it difficult. So when Intel came out with their most recent 14-nanometer technology, they actually delivered those chips 2 quarters late because they had yield problems. So as they go to higher and higher density now, the chips are more expensive. And so the question is it worth the price to go to the super high density chip? And so I think we're running near the end of Moore's Law. Now, there is one technique which is being developed to sort of get around these quantum effects or the cost of going smaller and smaller. They're going to stack them up and do 3D, and they'll start stacking devices on top, and they think they can get up to 32 layers. So if they can start making 3D chips, they may be able to extend Moore's Law even further by using the third dimension. So we would certainly hope that would be the case. So there you go. Gordon Moore, by the way, he's retired. He lives in Hawaii, and he couldn't be reached for comment on Moore's Law. I mean, I think he's pretty much done with Moore's Law. He's just enjoying life there out in Hawaii.
Good for him.
That's right.
We can just continue on, Doc. I see you got some stuff. I think we should just continue to the top of the hour. How's
okay, that sounds good. Well, there. A conference table that takes notes. You know, a few weeks ago, I talked about my Amazon Echo. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this device I can talk to it at home. It plays music. I can tell it to listen to Federal News Radio, and it will listen to Federal News Radio over TuneIn Radio automatically. It's Alexa.
What's this called again?
Amazon Echo.
This may be one of those days.
That's right. You were out. And so
I'm going to take a look at
and
that.
And so this Amazon Echo. And so I call Alexa. I say, Alexa, would you do this? And I'm going to, if I want to get to my shopping, I say, Alexa, you know, add eggs to my shopping list. She adds eggs to my shopping list. And then I get the shopping list sent to my iPhone. So, but the voice recognition of Amazon Echo is absolutely incredible. Also, voice recognition with Siri is very good. And so this ought to be useful for something. And so the research lab at New York Times, they said, you know, we got all these meetings, these editorial staff meetings. And what they noticed, all the meetings always were kind of around a table. People sit around a table and they take notes, they talk. They just felt comfortable sitting at a table. I guess just sitting around like at a, without a table, you feel like you're not working or something. So everybody would sort of gravitate to a table when they were working. So they thought, why don't we make a listening table? And the listening table will listen to the conversation, and it will take notes for you automatically. I mean, that's actually a pretty clever idea. So they designed this listening table. Now, part of the problem with the listening table, you know, if something's always listening to you, it's like a little creepy. You don't want it listening all the time.
To everything.
And so there's a switch on the side. You can turn it off, and whenever the listening table is listening, there's this ring of LEDs. I got a picture here. There's kind of a ring of LEDs, and there's kind of a wave-like pattern. So whenever the listening table is listening, the LEDs are sort of like waving. So you know it's listening.
Mm-hmm.
And if you turn it off, then the pattern goes off. So you always know if it's listening. And then, of course, people, when they're talking, you don't necessarily want notes of everything. And so they've got these capacitive strips on the table. So whenever you're talking, And that's a point you want in the notes, hit the table. And it takes and record, and it takes and translates 30 seconds before the tap and 30 seconds after the tap, and it gives you that 1 minute of voice plus the translation.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes key words out of it. So people can just be talking, and if there's a point you want to make, tap the table. And notes are taken.
Okay, there's a problem with this. Suppose you're in a meeting with somebody who's a table pounder. On, off, on, off.
That would be a problem. That would be a problem. That would be a huge problem.
Yeah.
So you'd have to tape that guy's hands to his...
Duct tape them to his knees or something.
Yeah, duct tape them to his knees. And so I actually thought this was... I think this is where it's going. This, like, I can tell Alexa. I just, you know, I'll say, Alexa, good night. She says, sleep tight. I mean,
who needs a spouse?
I know. I mean, and you know, and I can say, Alexa, would you play music? Would you play any kind of music? And she just plays it off the Amazon Prime list.
You have the coolest toys.
And that, you know what I especially love? Alexa, would you just stop talking? And boom, she just stops.
Amazing.
It's just absolutely
unbelievable.
Fantastic. But this, I think this voice recognition software is really good.
How much did the table cost? Do you know?
This is just the listening table. It was just made by at the Washington Times by the research department. It's not for sale.
Not for sale yet. Okay.
It's not for sale, but this is going to be, I think,
a big deal.
It's going to be a big deal. I think a listening table makes a lot of sense, you know, because then you don't need people that, you know, take notes and everything. And what this does after the meeting, it automatically sends the notes to the email address of everyone who attended.
You know, Richard Nixon kind of had a listening table. It got him into trouble.
He did, but mm-hmm. but the thing about that listening table is that nobody knew that you couldn't turn it off.
Exactly.
You couldn't turn it off. So and you know the problem is, well, with Nixon, he tried to whisper whenever he's doing something he didn't want to be picked up. But you know, it picked up his whispers. He said, "Now you know when we're going to break in this place here, I don't know what this is. We're gonna break into Watergate, and we're gonna do this." And he'd whisper, and the audio was so good it picked up everything.
I wish I could do my Nixon impersonation right now.
So there you go. The iRobot,
yes,
is having a big dispute with the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Now, who would have ever thought?
I had no idea.
That iRobot and the National Radio Astronomy Observatory would be in a battle. Now, iRobot is actually built by the Roomba. You know, it's the vacuum maker, iRobot, that makes this Roomba, that's sort of this automatic sweeper that goes around the house. So they wanted to make a similar robot, similar to Roomba, that would actually cut lawns. So they decided to build this thing to cut lawns, and in order to help the lawnmower to know when the edge of the lawn was, they were going to set up beacons all around the side of the yard. So it would come to a beacon, it would stop, and the beacons emitted at 6650 megahertz to 6675 megahertz. That was the frequency they wanted for these little beacons.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that the National Radio Astronomy Observatory is actually running a series of experiments where they are trying to detect methane in space, and they're doing it at exactly the same frequency.
Why, that sounds interesting.
So they're saying if you give this frequency band to iRobot, it's going to mess up all of our frequencies. So now the FCC has to decide whether they're going to allow that to happen. Wow, this just went so fast.
Yes, it did.
Listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu. Also, go to the Stratford University website at stratford.edu. And check out the programs and tell them that you heard about those programs on Tech Talk Radio.
If you tuned in late or would indeed like to hear this program again in its entirety, it'll be replayed tomorrow at 7 o'clock. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week here on Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFMHD2 Manassas, WTLPFMHD2 Braddock Heights Frederick, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics. Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO.
Federal News Radio's DoD Wednesday. At 3, DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, a discussion with senior managers about how the department meets its mission. At 4, in-depth host Francis Rose brings you Pentagon Solutions, a smart discussion on the issues and challenges of the defense community. Plus daily DoD updates, mornings and afternoons, Monday through Friday. DoD Wednesday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Sports here on Federal News Radio today. The Wizards are in Toronto to start the playoff run against the Raptors. The coverage starts at 12:15, tip off at 12:30. Sunny and nice today in the nation's capital. Beautiful day, high near 80 degrees. Right now outside our studios in Northwest D.C., it is 60 degrees under sunny skies.
Tech Tuesday on